This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Okay.
Welcome to episode 2 of The Diva Chronicles. Your host, your girl, Felicia George. You can call me Philly G because I'm cool with y'all. And my co-host,
Natasha Hastings. I don't have any cool nicknames, but...
I came up with Philly G because sometimes I freestyle if I'm on road trips.
Oh.
And that's my go-to.
Okay. Philly G. Yeah. All right. I mean, I guess I have the 400 meter diva, but yeah. No.
Okay, that's fine.
Y'all, okay, let's just keep it 100, y'all.
We just recorded a whole podcast.
Or we thought we recorded a whole podcast. 23 minutes, y'all. Silence.
We're new to this, so we obviously still working at the Kings. It was really good content. Y'all would have really enjoyed it, but we're gonna y'all know about
try to duplicate it
what
now.
We're doing here right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Today, we wanted to talk about the path towards the Olympic Games and the fact that that path isn't always just the 4 years that people think or see that lead up.
Right.
It's often quite longer and a lot more involved than most people realize. But the first thing we wanted to talk about was, when did you decide you wanted to become an Olympian?
Okay, so it was 1996.
Mm-hmm.
I was 10 years old. It was the summer after joining my track team, and the games were being held in Atlanta, Georgia. I remember watching Michael Johnson with the gold spikes. That's why I wear gold spikes now. Gail Devers, Jackie Joyner-Kersee, Otto Bolden. I know I'm forgetting some other folks. But, I just remember watching that. And, like, having started running track that summer, too, it was, like, putting those two together. Like, oh, this is what I could grow up to do. And,
right.
Yeah, so that the inspiration came from there when I was 10 years old.
Right. So, funny enough, my Olympic aspiration started in 96 as well. But, so you've just named off a bunch of American sprinters
athletes
that were like
excelling. I did name one, Trini.
True. But that year in 96, Donovan Bailey won the 100 meters.
He has a West Indian background too.
He's Jamaican. Everybody from Toronto is West Indian somehow. But anyways, he won the 100 and literally like etched in my mind is him crossing the finish line, like screaming, hands down, like just that moment of like pure joy.
Yeah.
Like remembering that. And in that moment, seeing him do that, I was like, yep, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to go to the Olympics. I wanted to experience that moment.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny at that young age to kind of like have that feeling. But I was like, I want that. So that was my main.
Well, dang. So if I was 10, because you're.
So no, I'm a year younger than you. What year are you born?
Are you just a year younger than me?
Yeah, I'm 31.
Oh, okay. When you turn 32?
In November.
Oh, okay. All right, back to the topic. Sorry about that.
But yeah, so all that's right. When I was like, okay, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, I think 96 was, every Olympic Games is electric.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, because, oh gosh. And I feel terrible saying this because, so we have, and you have two different paths to talk about.
Right,
like
yeah.
You also have your Winter Olympics to talk about, but I have the Beijing experience and the Rio experience.
Right.
And I think the thing that a lot of people remember most about any Olympics is like the opening ceremonies.
Right.
And then of course, no matter what, track is like,
yeah, the highlight.
Yeah.
We ain't gonna lie. It's the highlight.
It's the highlight.
Y'all know.
It's the true Olympic sport. But I remember being in Beijing, and Beijing was my first experience. And I was like, man, how is London going to top this?
Right.
I missed London, but everybody that came back from London said, man,
London was dope.
Like,
yeah.
I missed it. I was too depressed. I didn't even watch.
Yeah.
Whatever. And then Rio.
Yeah.
Let me start off by saying Rio did the best that Rio could do.
Yeah.
And I was one of those people that, like, hearing some of the things that other people were saying, whether it be the media, some of my teammates. I mean, first of all, driving, going through Brazil, it was kind of depressing. And it was like, you know, the stadium was like literally plopped in the middle of some favelas.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So it's like this $1 billion stadium.
Seeing the poverty. That was the,
yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Rio wasn't that. But I was also older. I was 30 at the time. And before I went to Rio, I made the conscious effort that, like, take every moment in. Because Beijing, I barely remember. Like,
right.
You're there to compete, and it's, like, over and done.
Yeah.
That's so, a
topic to talk about
it. Yeah. So, in Rio, I literally was like, nope. Even if I'm just having lunch in the cafeteria with the guys, the girls, like, I'm going to be in this moment.
Yeah.
But.
That's good. That's really good. Yeah.
I had to learn that. I was, like, 26 or 27, and maybe a little bit sooner than that. But I looked up and I was like, man, I've been to some crazy places in the world. And the only thing that I have to remember them by are these track meets and the stamps in my passport.
Right,
like,
right.
Nothing else.
Right.
So, yeah, I made that intention in Rio.
Right.
But Rio, it was, I mean, the stadium wasn't even packed. Yeah. Unless Bolt was running.
Yeah. I think I was running on the days that Bolt were running. So I had a little bit more.
The 4x4, it was packed. But our 400 final, it was like.
Right.
So.
I think for me, my first few days in Rio were very like, oh, what is this? Because I kept comparing it to London.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, London was like this. It was so good. London was that. And then I took a moment to be like, this is its own Olympics.
Yeah.
And you have to enjoy it for what it is.
Exactly.
So, yeah. I once I kind of made that conscious decision, I had a different experience. The only thing that like super irked me about Rio, going to the track for my heats. So bus schedules are horrible. Like, literally horrible. And there's, like, one bus every 3 to 4 hours. Yeah. It was something, like, you know, I had to stand.
Oh, yeah.
I had to, it was so packed. Yeah. And I was getting ready to run. And I was just, I'm, like, literally just standing there. And, like, the first 10 minutes, I'm just pissed. And I'm like, okay, you know what? It is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, you can't control this. Like, we're going to do the best we can once we get there. Shake me out, whatever. Right. But I was like, I am standing going to the Olympic for my heat. So I was like, so cheesed.
That was a Toronto thing. So cheesed. But no, and I mean, I hate to feel like, to sound like I'm piling it on, because by all means, Rio was a great experience for me in terms of performance.
Right.
But one of the things that I realize is being a part of Team USA, I mean, being in America, privilege is a word that we talk about.
For sure, for sure.
All the time. So there were things that, you know.
Canada.
But there were things that, you know, people were complaining about. And even the Americans as a team, we were complaining about. And I was just like, the audacity.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we had
first
our
world
own.
Problems.
Yeah, for really first world problems. Like, there were things that, you know, okay, it sucked not being able to flush toilet paper. But is it going to kill you?
No, yeah.
It was just little stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, overall, yeah, Rio was an experience in itself, as you say.
So let's talk about our paths to, let's say, our first Olympics.
Okay.
The like lead up.
Yes.
Into that.
Okay.
So let's talk about lead into.
Oh, so I was the first one because you, 12 and 16.
Yeah.
All right. So 2008, Beijing, I was 22.
Mm-hmm. So you're in school kind of a little bit, like in the quad leading up. You're in school.
I should have been in school.
Right. Okay.
So I turned professional after my junior year of college.
Okay.
And then I did go to that fall semester.
Right.
It was always kind of the plan. MJ was actually my first manager, Michael Johnson. Mm-hmm. So when I turned pro, he was like, you know, I'm definitely encouraging you to finish your degree, but for the Olympics, I think you should take the year off to solely focus on being a professional.
Yeah, training. And
exactly. So I was 22, would have been my senior year of college. I was very green, obviously. Mm-hmm. I did have the 2007 World Championships experience.
Okay.
But the thing that I remember... I went on the 4x4.
Okay.
I think, what place did I get at trials? I think I got 6th
at
trials. So, or maybe it was 5th. Whatever. I was there for the 4x4.
Yeah.
So, Karan Clement, one of my very close friends, actually, when I moved to LA the year after that, Karan and I were actually roommates. But anyway, Karan was like, whatever you do, don't look up in the stands. Speaking of, like, Olympic experiences. Yeah. So, what did I do when I walked out on the track?
Of course.
Looked up in the stands. Nonetheless, it was a great Olympics. We came home with a gold medal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was interesting because 2008 was sort of, I don't want to use the word the emergence, but it was like the Jamaicans.
Oh, right.
Because it was like Bolt, Shelly-Ann. I think the women, did the women sweep the 100?
Yeah. Sharon Simpson and Karan.
And Karan Stewart, yeah.
Karan Stewart, sorry.
What did you say?
I said Karan Clement, but just because you
just said because I just said him, so there was this, like, awakening of, like, oh.
Right.
This is what you want to do for a living. Like, this is, you know. 2008 was interesting. But, yeah.
What would you say was your biggest struggle leading into that Olympics? Or let's say, okay, leading into either of the Olympics, any of these Olympics.
Well, no, leading into 2008, the biggest thing was when I came out of college, I was, I said I came out early. Mm-hmm. So going into the World Championships in 2007, I was the number one quarter miler in the world. Mm-hmm. So there was a tremendous amount of pressure on me. Now, let me take that back. Going into the U.S. Nationals, I was the number one quarter miler in the world.
Right.
After that, I was second in the world because I got second at U.S. Nationals.
Right.
I didn't make it out of the semi-round. I didn't make it to the final because I had that whole...
At Nationals?
No, at Worlds.
Okay, right. Osaka. Oh, right, yeah.
I had that whole collegiate season under my belt.
Yeah, that's right.
So, didn't make it out of the final. So, next year, it was that, you know, she just had college legs, mm-hmm. she's gonna bounce back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't necessarily have the... You're just kind of thrown to the wolves. Mm-hmm. If you don't have anyone there to, like, kind of guide you and, like, you know, you got all this pressure on you. I know there's this expectation to be, you know, this next whatever in the women's 400. So, yeah, I kind of fell victim to that. Let me not say victim, but I kind of fell to that pressure as in, like, figuring out professional is a lot different from college. And I think the hardest lesson that I had to learn was that I wasn't going to get away with training the way that I did in college.
Right.
Because in college, I raced a lot. My junior year of college, I ran 4x1, some weekends 4x2, 4x4, 400. And sometimes a 200. At regionals, I ran 2x4, 4x1, 4x4.
Right. So you in shape. You race shape.
Training? Like, I was running so much on the weekends that, you know, I was just naturally in shape. Yeah. But when you turn pro, you don't have all those races to get in shape.
Yeah.
So that was probably the hardest thing for me to figure out. And it took a while for me to get that together.
Right.
Years after that.
Yeah. Interesting. There was something you were talking about. Oh, yeah. I think it's interesting because, like, as athletes, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves.
A lot.
And so when you have outside pressure on you on top of that, it's like, ugh, like, that's definitely a really difficult thing to deal with.
Yeah.
So, and learning how to, like, I think outside pressure, like, one, learning how to, like, ignore that, but then also learning how to, like, not put that pressure on yourself. Yeah. To be, like, ambitious and to be going towards something, but not acting like it's going to be the end of the world type of thing.
Yeah, I was probably, like, 27 before I figured that out.
Yeah.
But
no, for sure.
But, yeah, that was a tough, a really tough transition for me. Right. And I think it didn't help the company that I was in because, you know, Michael Johnson was my agent. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Warner was... one of my, like, he was also MJ's client.
Right,
so
right,
we,
right.
like, pretty much moved together. I was training with Veronica Campbell, Tyson Gay.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, you need to perform to be, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And not that, I said it didn't help. Not that those guys made it any more, or they were adding pressure. It was just I was just thrown into a situation that I just was not prepared for.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah. Interesting.
So let's hear about your journey, because you have two journeys to the Olympics.
I do. So we'll start with going into 2012.
Yes.
So that's my very first Olympics. So what's a little bit different, so you kind of, you left early and was kind of like, you know, top in the world. And, you know, I only made NCAAs in my senior year. That was the first time I went to an NCs. So, like, for me, every year was just, like, chipping away, getting a little bit better, a little bit better. I went into university running 1440 in hurdles. So,
okay.
I was slow, yeah. Like, I was slow. And I finished, so my senior year, I ran 1339 that year. And I think a big thing for me, and this is an interesting with Canadians and U.S., I went into university, like, soft and like a baby, and I wasn't aggressive. And I even remember, like, one of my first practices, and my coach will tell you to this day, like, I couldn't figure out, like, we were doing a hurdle drill, and I couldn't figure it out, and I started crying. Yeah.
Felicia, you were crying?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
I don't even know who that girl is. Like, I don't know who she is. Like, so I think for me, competing in the NCAA, like, literally just toughened me up.
Yeah.
Made me super aggressive. And you can't be a successful sprinter if you're not
that kind of,
like, I'm going to slit your throat type of deal. So I think that was, like, I just
didn't
have that.
That was kind of graphic, but it's the truth.
It's true.
It's the truth.
I just didn't have that. So I think it was just, like, years of, like, gaining that.
Yeah.
So, but even graduating, you know, I was running 1339, everybody was kind of like, I graduated with a 3.9 GPA, really good grades. I wanted to go to med school. And everybody was like, you know what? Like, it's been a good run. Track was nice. Go to med school. Go do your thing. Because it ain't going to happen for you in track type of thing.
So I'm just curious. Do people, like, outright say that to you? Or is it like...
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
I mean, I'm the sly. And I'm going to hate to say this, but I family members... Yeah,
family members.
We said that, and it's like they think they're doing something loving for you,
yeah.
And they think they're helping you make
the best decision. Especially coming from a West Indian family. Right? Let me take a step back.
My father's a teacher.
Oh gosh, that's even worse.
My father's a teacher. Education always came first. They're like, listen, look at this good stable role that you can have. Why are you gonna go here and choose this uncertainty?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just like, and even like me going from high school into university. Mm-hmm. They were like, because I wasn't highly recruited, it was kind of like, just stay in Canada.
Really?
Just stay in Canada. You can get a full scholarship because I had really good grades. You can get an academic scholarship. And I was like, y'all, I want to go to the U.S. on an athletic scholarship.
Don't tell me you threw a tantrum for that, too.
No, I didn't throw a tantrum. I was like,
kind of, y'all.
Yeah, I was like, I'm doing this.
Okay.
Like,
all right.
Y'all can say I should quit, but I'm continuing. Anyways, so, I mean, there's a lot that happens within this. So, I should also mention something that added to my struggle. In my senior year, my mom passed away from breast cancer.
Oh.
Yeah. Literally 4 days before I graduated from school.
From high school?
No, from university.
Oh, my gosh.
So in 2010. Okay. So I kind of had that. And so I think that also kind of was a little bit of a motivation to continue.
Yeah.
Because my mom was like a huge supporter. And was like, we talked about going to the Olympics, so let's stay on this.
Yeah.
So made the decision to move back to Toronto. Mm-hmm. And then I had a professional coach. So Priscilla Lipsleep was training there at the time. She won a bronze medal in 2008.
I remember Priscilla. Where is she these days? I know she had a couple kids, got married.
Nebraska, I believe.
That's where she went to school,
her
right?
Girls are And her, she met her husband. Let me give her all her
permission. We're talking about track, so, you know, give
she
the
met her husband.
History
she
lesson.
She met her husband out there, and so I think they moved back there.
Okay.
But she had won a bronze medal in 2008, so I was like, okay, cool, this is like a really cool opportunity.
Right.
And I'll have a professional coach, you know, full-time. Moving back home was a benefit for me because I wasn't sponsored at the time. And so I could live at home for free, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, we also had this group of people who were all really, really talented, but like had done nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just all like literally on this like grind of like, we're going to show them. We're going to like prove ourselves. And I had a coach who told me all the time that, like, you could be the best hurdler in the world.
Yeah.
And
that makes the world of a difference. Seriously. Yeah.
Like, and at a time when I wasn't even, like, I was like, I want to go to the Olympics. It wasn't even, like, you know, like, trying to, like, be anything more than that. I was like, I want to just say I'm an Olympian.
Oh, okay.
The goal was, like, I want to go to the Olympics. But then he's, like, talking all this talk, like, no. Like, you can be the best in the world.
Yeah.
And when you have somebody, like, telling you that, like, I mean, my whole view and confidence just totally, my view of myself totally changed. Yeah. And he held me to a standard, like, a world-class standard.
Yeah.
Like, if the times that I was supposed to be hitting in practice is, like, okay, this is, like, to run 12.5. This is to run this. This is so to win a medal. And I'm, like, okay, but I run 13.3. You know what I mean? But over time, it was like, okay, no, this is the standard, and this is, like, what we're working towards. Yeah, so that year was just, like, a grind towards that.
You said a couple of things that I'm, like, like, just, like, speaking to the standard of training. So, first of all, like, me choosing South Carolina with Coach Fry, one of the things that went into that decision-making process was, you know, when I was being recruited by him, I should say, because by the time I got there, it was different. He had Alan Johnson, Terrence Shamel, Lashinda Demus was in school, but it was obvious she was about to go pro. So I was like, oh, I can go here and run collegially, but if the pro thing works out for me, I can train with him.
Yeah.
Then very quickly found out that, you know, having a college coach trying to train professionally, it's, for some it might work, but there's just different. it's very different.
Yeah.
But talking about the level, right? Mm-hmm. I remember when I moved down here to train with D2, the first couple of practices, there were some times that he was giving me the hit. And mm-hmm. I mentioned that, like, I had to address that, like, training had to step up a notch, right?
Yeah.
And I remember calling my mom a couple of times, like, he told me to run 16 in the 150. Like, what?
Right.
Who?
Yeah.
Like, how? Like, because I was coming from South Carolina where, believe it or not, I was running my 150s at practice in 18s.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
Like, 18 to 16? Like, how?
Right.
But I'm a very coachable person. And as much as I was like, I don't know how I'm supposed to do that, but I got to 16 somehow. You know what I mean? So there really is something to be said about, and even taking it a step further, I didn't make the 2012 Olympics.
Right.
I moved down here the day after Christmas, 2011. So I was training for 2012. I missed 2012 by one spot for the relay. And I was ready to quit. Like, I was like, psh, I'm going back to school.
Yeah.
This got lost in the first podcast, but when I moved down here, I was like, if this doesn't work, I'm going back to school. I'm going to go be a chiropractor. But it really was the people around me from D2, my mom, my brother, my sports therapist that was like, nah, you can do this. Like, so there's like a true testament to, like, if you don't believe in yourself, you have to surround yourself with the people that do, because there are going to come times that they got to fill your tank back up, essentially.
It's true.
So
I'm a huge believer in, like, I feel like I'm really sensitive to people's energy.
Mm.
And I only try and put, like, positive people around me. And people who are, like, in Felicia George's corner.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, I don't even, if I even get the inkling that you ain't on Team PG, deuces. Like, you need to keep it moving. Because, like you said, like, a big part of what we do is believing in ourselves and having confidence in ourselves. But there are the moments that it's not there, and you need people around you to be like, okay, if I'm two notches down, I need you to bring me up that three. So
that makes me think of another thing that's interesting, right? Because I agree with you wholeheartedly. Like, and I can even say I've probably been intentional about that as early as high school, that maybe not surrounding myself with people that have the same goals, but people that were going in a positive direction, right? And not trying to distract me from what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I've found that in my professional life, one of the things that I feel really guilty about is some of the sacrifices that I've made over the years.
Yeah.
And that being with my family and friends.
Yeah.
Like, missing graduations, missing...
Yeah.
Basically, all of my friends have kids.
Yeah.
Missing, you know, that, weddings.
My goddaughters are turning one in a few...
One? Yeah. I have, like, a 13-year-old goddaughter.
Yeah. But I'm saying, like, they're having their birthday, and I'm like, I can't come. I have to train.
And you just miss everything, birthday.
Right? Yeah.
But sometimes I feel incredibly guilty missing those things. And then sometimes there are conversations that I have with those friends, which is interesting enough because all of my friends have come from track. Like, mm-hmm. I have a few here and there that, you know, come from different walks of life, but my long-term friends have come from track.
Yeah.
And there'll be some conversations sometimes where I'll be like, all right, you don't get it. I'll talk to you later. Bye. Mm. And not like, and it's, I don't mean it in a way that like condescending or, cause there are things about their life that I'm like, girl, I don't get it. I can't relate. Right. So, and I've said it a few times too. Like, I don't know why you calling me. Cause I ain't got that advice. I don't have the answer. You know what I mean? Like when I was single, my married friends calling me going off. I'm like, girl,
I ain't the one.
Cause if you listen to me, you going to be single too.
Right.
But like, so I find that that has been like a thing for me because it's like, again, I've had to train myself to think and be a certain way that there are certain conversations that I can't even entertain because it's like, that's not, I can't go there.
Yeah. But that's setting boundaries. And this is like, I think it's just like knowing, like I can't have this conversation because I know the mindset that that's going to put me in.
Right.
So, and so I'll say with this, for me, my people like that is my family. Damn. And I mean like, but I think you're fortunate in the sense that your parents ran track.
Yeah.
Your mom ran track. So she kind of has an idea, has an inkling. And I know it's all love from my family, but they don't know.
Yeah.
So I just don't have those conversations with them anymore.
Yeah.
I feel
bad saying the things that I said because I have awesome friends.
Yeah.
I do. And likewise, you, I'm sure you have awesome family, but it's, they don't get it.
Yeah. It's no shade on them. It's no, like, we love you. We know they love us, but it's like, if I have this conversation with you, I could have two bad weeks of practice and I cannot afford that.
I can't afford that.
So I'm not going to have this conversation.
Yeah.
So like.
It sounds so extreme and it's the truth. Yeah. I don't know what else to say about it, man. Yeah. Like, and speaking of my mom, I mean, it's so big ups to my mom. My mom that was a New York thing right there. My mom made the 84 Olympics for Trinidad. But we even got to a place where I had to reestablish our boundaries.
Right.
And not because, again, like, she meant well and, you know, but I got to a place where I was like, I realized what I was doing wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about, like, channeling my energy and the things that I focused on and all of those things, I realized I had to take myself away in a way that, you know, not that she was doing anything wrong. It was just what I had to do to figure out, you know, the sport or figure myself out in the sport.
Yeah.
Because interestingly enough, the things that she would be saying would be encouraging things.
Right.
But it would be things like, for example, we all know it's a process. We all know it's a journey. Yeah. So mom coming from a track background, she has a relationship with D2. They probably talk more than me and D2 talk.
Really?
Swear.
I love her.
But, you know, sometimes things don't click
as
fast as we would like them to.
Yeah.
And so I remember one season, actually, I think it was 2013. It was right after coming back from 2012. And I had a not so great race. Like, I had a really good race and then had a not so great race. But I was still putting the pieces together, you know?
Yeah.
I had that race that was like, oh, bitch, you still got... Oh. The passion was coming out there. But I had that race where I was like, ooh, you it's still there. Got it, you know? And then I had one afterwards that it was like, oh, wait, was that a fluke?
Right.
But at that time, I was working with a sports psychologist. And my mom, I don't even remember the message that she sent me. I just remember she sent me a message.
Yeah.
And I immediately remember looking at the message and I was like, nope, not doing it.
Yeah.
Because it was like, I'm not panicking. Like, I knew I had a bad race.
Right.
But I was like, it's not time to hit the panic button.
Right.
I'm good. You know what I mean?
I don't need the essay.
You know what I mean? The essay. Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, she meant well. Mm-hmm. She was only coming from a great place.
Yeah.
But I had to learn that,
no.
Me and Coach got this. Like, you know? And I think... I don't know if we've ever talked about it. I know she's going to listen to this podcast and probably be like,
she's like, what?
Why are you telling these people our business? Yeah. I didn't do no such thing. But but it was a moment for me. And I'm sure since then, like, she's realized, like, right. Because I've seen, like, the change in, all right, let me give her space to do her thing.
Right.
So, I mean, it comes from both sides where it's like, what are you doing? Or, you know, you could be doing X, Y, and Z, but it's still, you still have to set those boundaries for yourself.
For sure. That's important. Setting them boundaries. Something I was just thinking about. So for me, so I competed in London and in Rio. Mm-hmm. I still got to talk about Winter Olympics. But anyway,
oh yeah, the Winter Olympics. I'm going to
just do a super quick lead up into Rio. So coming off of 2012, so 2 years ago, everybody's telling me quit track. I made the Olympic finals, ran a personal best in the semis and in the finals. So I'm like, the best I could have been.
Yeah, you did it where it counted. Yeah.
Right. The next year, I got injured. So the thing is, coming off of 2012, I'm like, ooh, I'm about to give it to them. Yeah. Like, next year's about to be crazy. Like, in my mind, like, that's it. Like, I got track on a wrap. And then I got hurt. But the thing is, I would have like glimmers of like, I'm flying, I'm in amazing shape, but my body was like, you need to sit down and chill. And I didn't. And then I ended up tearing my hamstring in two places on the other leg. Lord. Right. So that whole year was a wash. I basically didn't compete in 2013. Then 2014, we did a rehab that whole year, 'cause I just had chronic hamstring issues anyways. 2014, my confidence was trash. Mm. Like, I was afraid to sprint again. And so
you're not only sprinting, you have hurtling obstacles. Yeah.
And I hurt myself hurtling.
Okay.
And so like, it just, that aggression was never there. And it was like, okay, 2014 basically became a wash. Mm-hmm. And then 2015, I started kind of finding it again, but then I was like, you know what? I need to make a change. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like just decided to like, okay, I'm gonna hop out on this leap of faith. And that's when I moved to Baton Rouge.
Okay. Up until this time, you were still with the same coach in Toronto. Yeah. Okay.
And it's hard because I had success with him.
Yeah.
And so I wanted, like, I kept being like, no, like, he can do this for me. He can do this for me. And it was nothing on him. It was like, I need a new environment, because if I stay here, like, my mind will stay in that place.
Right.
You know? So, yeah. And I moved in an Olympic year. In 2016.
Girl, I did it in 2012, so I already know.
And it was really like, whoo, like, yo, you just got to grind here right now, because when you move to a new program, you just never know, right?
It's a gamble.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I found my mojo a little bit again, made the Olympic finals again, so.
So, yeah. But speaking of, like, having success with a coach and then, like, making a decision, because, like, I feel like, I want to say in our sport, but I feel like in all sports, there's like this loyalty thing, right?
Yeah.
And so, speaking of having been with D2 since 2012, didn't make the team, stuck with me through that. 2013 was like, I won U.S. Nationals.
Yeah.
I placed fifth at Worlds, now fourth, because we not good. That's another topic. We need to write that down for another podcast. as Felicia reaches for the pen.
Yeah.
But, in 2016, I actually made the decision that, not that I was going to leave D2, but that I was going to do supplemental work.
Oh, I remember seeing this.
Yeah. And it was a hard one, because by no means did I want to offend D2, because, again, loyalty stuck by me. I had great success with him. But I also got to a point where I was like, I feel like I'm running good.
Yeah.
But I'm just not. Yeah. Something just. Yeah. You know, give me a little ting.
Yeah.
So, let me take that back, because some people might take that the wrong way.
Yeah.
Like, not no drugs, but so I made the decision to train with Otto Bolden it was once a month.
Can I say something about Otto?
Sure.
I don't even know if I want to put this on here.
Uh-oh.
Otto was my, like, crush. So you talking about, we talking about watching the 96 Olympics?
Woo!
I, like, literally, I'm watching Otto, like, whew.
Okay, well, since we're being transparent here, not Otto, but, oh my gosh, why am I black? I'm looking at his face.
Limpered.
Sat on the track. No!
Oh, John Drummond?
John Drummond. Oh. Why did I want to call him Tim? Yeah, John with the pretty eyes was my
That's how I was like swooning, like, ooh, Otto. And now, you know, being but, in the sport, but
things are a little different now.
I was 10. Oh, well, I was 9.
Girl. We're gonna leave that alone. Yeah.
Anyway, how did D2 respond to you saying you wanted to do that?
I don't think he was very fond of it, to be
but he's
honest.
Kind of, I feel like he's laid back, and I think I've, at least from being with him for this short period of time, he seems like he understands like what it is to be professional and just wants you to do what's best for you.
Right. And I think that's more of a, you know, this is what she wants to do. I may agree or disagree with it, but I'm going to stay in my lane, be professional about it.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think it was necessarily something that he was excited about. Also, honestly, I didn't really give him much of a choice.
Right.
Where I was just like, yeah, I was like, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I mean, he had the choice in that he could have said, no, I'm not working with you anymore. Right. But it was just one of those things where I was like, D2 gets me in awesome shape. Like, I can, from November to September, damn near October, I'm running fast because of the workouts that D2 is putting on me. Like, straight up. But there were just some technique things and some speed things. I always say that I think that I'm a fast quarter miler.
You're 2 minutes fast, too. So,
So there were some things that I wanted to work on with Otto that I just didn't necessarily feel like I was getting here from D2. So it was a tough decision because, again, being loyal, not wanting to offend anyone. And then I was having to battle the whole, oh, so are you training with Otto full time? I was like, no. I'm in Miami for 2 days out of the month.
Yeah.
I'm with D2 for the rest of the time. And so that was something that was like important to me too, because then now going on to Rio and having success, I didn't want to take that away from D2 because who was in the gym with me?
Right. Day in, day out.
Day in, day out. And also not taking away from what me and Otto did. But, you know, but yeah, like having to make those professional choices for yourself, right? Yeah. That like some people may not like this. They may not even get why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Right.
Because even in explaining to some people, I could see on some people's faces like, what?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
But I mean, I was 30 and I had like 2 PBs that season, you know?
Right,
so it was like, you may not get it, but I get what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. Yeah. So, I can totally relate to like you having that success, but then realizing I need to try something different.
Something needs to change.
Something needs to change.
Yeah. I think for me, I guess something that I've always, well, later in my career that I've really stuck to is taking full responsibility for my career. Like, full response. Like, there's no, if I have a bad season, I don't, it's not my coach's fault. It's, I take full responsibility. Mm-hmm. And that is now my, it's my job to then evaluate what needs to change or what needs to happen. So, and I think a lot of people, a lot of athletes get caught up in, you know, blaming everybody else, but looking at, rather than looking at themselves.
Especially in track. That happens.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because I think, you have to take full responsibility. You have to be willing to speak up for yourself and understand that, like, this is your career. You only have but so many years.
Yeah.
And so you have to take advantage of it. But I'm wondering if, do you think it was, well, you did it, but I'm saying, like, as a woman, having to now speak up and say, like, hey, like, this is what I need. This is what, did you think, do you feel like that played any type of, 'cause I think sometimes people don't, subconsciously, you know what I mean? It's like, expect women to kind of, you're supposed to just go with the flow.
You know, I never thought of it that way, but now that you put it that way, because now what you're saying makes me think back to even in college, well, not in college, but making the choice to come down to Texas from South Carolina. And I remember going to Coach Fry's office before making the decision to come down here. And I didn't even, at that point, I wasn't even, like, thinking of leaving, I don't think.
Right.
But I went in his office. Oh, man.
Come on.
I thought I took care of this. I'm
strike
sorry.
Two.
I'm sorry. How did we do this again?
Go. Yeah, wasn't. No, press that.
It was that.
No, go today. Press it today. Oh. But there was something that said, do not disturb or something.
I don't know. Okay, we'll try to act like that didn't happen.
I don't know what happened.
Press you go. Can you, like, scroll up or scroll down or something like that?
No.
Yeah.
There it is. Okay. Sorry, we're back. And so, I wasn't happy with the way things were going with training. And so I went in his office to talk to him about it. And because talking about taking ownership about it. And I'll never forget. we're being real here. So this is not meant to be like a bash session or anything like that. But I remember Coach Fry giving me an article to read. And the article, in a nutshell, was about taking accountability. Hmm. And I read the article. And you know how, like, you're going through something, you're reading something, and you're like, all right.
Yeah.
I go do for you. And so I finished reading the article, and I really don't remember what Coach Fry said at that point. But I just remember the words, you know, taking accountability for what I was doing.
Right.
And I remember distinctly saying to him, and this was probably the hardest thing I ever had to say to Coach Fry up to that point was, Coach Fry, I'm sitting in front of you right now because I'm taking accountability.
Right.
Because I know that what we're doing is not working.
Right.
And if I allow this to continue, it's my fault.
Yeah.
You know, so even taking ownership of what's happening and realizing that, okay. And I think I left that meeting still not wanting to leave.
Right.
Because of all the other things, but realizing, if something doesn't change, this isn't going to work.
Right.
So, and that's another thing. I mean, I was 25 at the time. So 25, talking to my college coach. So not only talking about being green, but like that power dynamic of Coach Fry was the man in track and field, and going into his office and having that conversation. I think I was literally shaking.
Oh, yeah. I hate confrontation.
I despise it. Really? I avoid it at all costs.
I feel like you
talk about it. Nah.
I will jip and jive before a confrontation. All right, we got to do this.
For me to say something, you literally have to back me into a corner, which is what I felt like sitting in the office that day. Because it was like any other time I would have taken it from him and I would have been like, yeah, Coach Fry, you're right.
Yeah.
But I was like, it was literally in that moment reading that paper. I was like, nah, bruh.
Yeah.
I see what you're doing here. Yeah, not this time.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So. I think it's an interesting dynamic because I'm also a very firm believer of trusting your coach and trusting your program.
Same.
Like, if I've made the decision to be in a program,
I'm here because I trust you. Yep.
I'm going to give you, so at least for this whole year, I'm going to be here, and whatever you say, I'm doing it.
Right.
Like, I mean, I like to think of, like, my coach-athlete relationship as a partnership. So, yeah, I'm going to ask questions. I'm going to hopefully, you know, we'll do it together. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you're the coach, and I trust you, and I trust your decisions. And I need to trust your program.
But, you know, you say that, and I think that is the biggest reason why I've had the success that I've had with D2.
Yeah.
Because it's a collaborative effort versus me going to a program and this is my program.
There's no changing.
I say, that's it.
Yeah.
Because I went to a couple of programs and I was like, okay, so when are we going to do 30s and 60s? And they were like, you've run the 400. What are you talking about?
Right.
And I was like, well, have you seen my 200 time? Have you seen my 100 time? Like, I need speed work.
Right.
My 400 is fast because of my 200s.
Right.
And coming down to Austin with D2, like, I had that voice.
Right.
And, like, I trust you. And even having the confidence in your coaching that when I ask you a question, it's not me questioning you, but let me understand what I'm doing. Yeah. Okay, so why are we doing this? Yeah. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Can we do it maybe this way? That like let it be a collaborative effort versus we're just out there and you're dictating to me, you know. Yeah. And
but I think it's also okay. It's saying this is what has worked for me in the past.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I feel like I need. I'm gonna let you implement it how you see fit.
Right.
But I'm just letting you know
that this is. Don't get me wrong, there are definitely those days that D2 is like, all right, doing this.
Yeah.
But sometimes, most days, and I mean, there have been days that like we'll show up to practice and we'll be like, okay, D2, what are we doing today?
Right.
And he's like, I don't know if he's hit you with this yet, but he'll be like, well, I kind of wanted to see how y'all are feeling first, and then we'll decide, and we'll be like, what is the workout?
Let me know the workout. Because then you're doing the whole warm-up, like, ooh.
Yeah, like, you don't know how to warm up, hard.
Yeah.
No. All right, well, I think that's a safe space to wrap up. What do you think? Oh, no, okay. Yeah. We're going to do one more topic, and then we're really going to wrap up. Yeah. You can tell we're amateurs here. Just bear with us, y'all. So how did you choose to run for Canada? Because run and slay.
Yeah.
Well, or is it sled? You didn't even talk about your bobsleigh.
We going all kind of
all over the place.
I'll just talk about Winter Olympics super quickly and just say, I'm like, I'm so mad we lost that other stuff.
Girl.
So after the 2016 Olympics, I had a Twitter message waiting for me. And Kaylee Humphries, who I ended up sliding with, was asking me if I was interested in competing at the Winter Olympics. And it really was not even something that I was considering. Because I'm like, okay, you're crazy. You want me to dash myself down, you know, some ice? I'm good.
Dash myself down. That is a true West Indian saying there.
Right? But I couldn't like kind of get the idea out of my head. And so I was like, you know, this could be kind of cool to like, you know, represent my country for the Winter Olympics. So, and it was a much harder transition than I thought it was going to be.
I wonder, because we like to highlight, how many Canadians have done that? Done the two sport, summer, winter?
I don't know. I think when we were counting, it might have been something like 10.
Oh, maybe. Okay. Y'all are up there. Yeah. I think we only have, we're in the single digits for sure.
Yeah, it might have been something like 10. But I mean, like Winter Olympics, winter sport is a lot bigger
in Canada.
And it would be something like a lot of people do cycling and like ski racing, like that was a popular one. But I'm the first Canadian Black woman to compete in the summer and Winter Olympics.
Okay, come on for the Black women.
We're gonna talk about Canada. So, because I have Grenadian citizenship as well as Canadian citizenship.
You have the citizenship, too.
I have my passport. I have my Grenadian passport.
Okay, all right.
So,
were you born in Toronto? I'm sorry, I'm hijacking your story.
Let me talk now.
Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. I was born in Canada. Okay. Me and my brother are the only ones that were born in Canada.
Okay.
All my older sisters were born in Grenada.
All your older sisters? How many siblings do you have?
I have three older sisters.
Oh, and okay.
I had the option. I'm like, what am I talking
I'm
about?
Shut up. I'm gonna
shut up. I had the option of competing for Grenada or competing for Canada.
Okay.
And at the time, so mind you, at the time I'm running 13.3, right?
So this is 2012.
No, this is 2011.
Okay.
So, because my first world champs was in 2011 out in Tobago.
Okay.
At the time, there was three world-class 100-meter hurdlers from Canada, one of them being a world champion. One of them was ranked top in the world the year before.
So I'm thinking Perdita, Priscilla.
And then Angela, who was an Olympic finalist in 2020. Angela White.
Okay, I know her.
So that being said, everybody that I spoke to was like, you'll never make a Canadian team in the 100-meter hurdles. And I mean, they were looking at the times I was running, and in their minds, they're like, you're not even competitive with those girls. And I was like, you know what? I like a little challenge. Because I was like, no, like, my thinking was like, I'm not going to shy away from that.
Yeah.
And if I make a team, I want to make a team because, like, you know, I worked for it. And I the way I thought about it was, if I make this team and I beat those girls, that means when I go to a championship, I'm going to be ready.
Right.
So I was like, I'm not going to go run for Grenada to run away from these girls.
Hmm.
And all this running 13.3, like, ain't even in the conversation. But, 2011, like I said, I, like, just slowly chipped away. I think I ran a PB every single race that year.
Damn.
Like, every single time I... And then, I mean, you doing that, you just start feeling yourself. Yeah, like, yeah, I was like, I'm PBing in the 100, 200, every time I stepped on the track in the hurdles. And so I ended up going to nationals. And I, in my mind at that point, I was like, I'm going to win nationals. Mm-hmm. Ended up coming second. But then I think maybe the weekend after, we all raced again. And then I won that race. And it was okay. It was kind of big because I beat Perdita.
Yeah.
And Perdita was like the 100-meter hurdler. And it was kind of... I mean, that's what I feel like sealed my Nike deal, like, at that point. Like, that's when Nike started, like, you know, showing interest. Mm-hmm. And then went to Daegu, so my first world championships, made the finals. I ran a PB there, 12:73, I think, at the time. So from...
Daegu was 11?
2011. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, and I was like, hey, I guess I made a good decision on that. Mm-hmm. Showed y'all.
So mine is similar but different.
Yeah.
So it was 2002. God.
Well, you out there making youth teams.
Listen, it was 2002 and World Juniors was in Jamaica that year.
Ooh.
So let me give y'all a little bit of my history. I, Natasha Monique Hastings, was born in Brooklyn, New York.
Right.
My mother was born in Twickenham, London.
Right. She was born in London?
She was born in London.
Did not know that.
But she moved to Trinidad when she was 13, and my father is from Westmoreland, Jamaica.
Right.
So I naturally had the options, U.S., the UK, or Jamaica.
Right.
My grandfather to this day is like, if you wanted to run for Trinidad, you could have run for Trinidad.
I was going to say, I would have put Trinidad in there too.
We would have pulled some strings. But anyway, World Juniors was in Jamaica that year. We were at Penn Relays, and my high school, we were usually pretty competitive for Penn Relays in high school, and somehow they figured the Jamaicans just know.
Yeah.
Like,
we about,
they know who their people are. Yeah. So, they were talking, one of the coaches was talking to my mom about me running possibly for Jamaica that summer, and my mom hates when I tell this story, but to this day, I don't know who this man was.
Okay.
But the man was like, I mean, let's be honest, she'll never make a U.S. team anyway.
Ooh. So you don't even know me.
So my mom told me that, like, and I mean, they were giving me gears. They gave my mom gear, like, all kinds of, don't go back and take my college scholarship now. I don't know if that's an NCAA violation or what. But they gave my mom gears, like, you know, really, like, pushing hard for me to run for Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And then that, I just remember that was the last thing my mom told me. And I was like, okay, conversation done.
Yeah.
2002, I ended up getting hurt. 2003, I made my first U.S. team for the World Youth. And I've been on every single U.S. team since 2003.
Whoop.
Well, let me not say every single, but least one team since then. But yeah, it was homeboy telling my mom, like, oh, she'll never make a U.S. team. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, if people hadn't said that to me, I might have even have actually considered it.
Even thought about it. Yeah. Because then even when I was turning pro now, and it was like, wait, you're British too?
Yeah.
That was another conversation of, like,
the UK. I would have had to give it an option.
I mean, so, but here's the thing though, right? Because I can sit here and say, you know, hindsight, maybe I could have, because, you know, I would be sitting on that British pound.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I get to be a part of such a legacy here in the U.S.
Yeah.
So it's kind of one of those things where, like, I'm going to take it a step further and compare. My fiance played much of his professional career with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Right.
And one of the things that we talk about, like, there's this big thing in the media right now with Antonio Brown leaving, Le'Veon Bell, da-da-da-da-da, all these things. Those guys stuck around for years to get those championships,
right.
You know?
Right.
And it didn't happen for them. But, like, my fiance has a Super Bowl championship, and then they also, he went to the Super Bowl again. So he's been twice,
right?
But they won once. But we've talked all the time about some of those guys staying for lesser money. They know they can go somewhere else
and
earn way more, but those championships, man. So kind of similar, where, like, Yeah, good. The British pound sounds
really nice. On the day-to-day, but...
But, yeah. You know, like, in Rio, I think our championship, our 4x4 was the fifth straight U.S. win. And however fat, like...
Yeah,
4x4
is crazy.
I'm blessed to be a part of a legacy that I wouldn't have any other way. Yeah. So...
But I think even for me, also another thing that made a kind of a big change or in my mind was... I was like, you know what? If I win in a medal and stand on the podium, I want to hear the Canadian anthem. Mm. Like, it was like, I don't even know the words of the Canadian anthem to sing it. So it was kind of like, really, I had to really, like, in that moment, what do I want? And
that's true.
And I'm sure for you, like, if you really thought about it, like, you, I think.
I don't think I ever thought of it in that context, in the sense beyond... There's no greater honor than standing on top of the podium and hearing your national anthem, although the American anthem
is
a little, you know. But, and I mean, like, I know I've heard stories about, like, the British media is...
Yeah.
And I know they ripped the Ophelia sisters, Tiffany.
Yeah. She paid away for her sister, so
that was
easier.
Yeah. But, gosh, there was something I was getting ready to say that slipped my mind that quick. I'm getting old. But no, standing on the podium, national anthem.
You don't remember. Anyways,
it was something about competing for US, but yeah. I don't remember. And watch, we're going to turn the mic off and I'm going to remember.
Yeah.
All right. It wasn't important.
Okay. I think that's a good place to end on Tasha losing her memory and not knowing what she's saying. But anyways, thanks for tuning into episode 2, y'all. Packed towards the Olympics with a whole bunch of other stuff within there.
But I think it was all, like, leading to how did we get there.
Yeah, for sure.
Last time we didn't mention where you guys can find us. I'm on Instagram and Twitter, Natasha Hastings.
And Instagram and Twitter. I need to step up my Twitter game, but we're doing that at Felicia George with a PHYLICIA because, y'all, my spelling is unique.
Really? I thought PH was the traditional spelling.
No, it's FE.
Oh.
If I get Starbucks, they put FELICIA.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, bye, Felicia.
Oh, gosh.
We'll catch you guys next time. Hope you enjoyed. Mm-hmm.